Olympic rower Ginny Gilder has written the new book Course Correction, a story of rowing and resilience in the wake of Title IX. In the book, she explores the many questions she faced during her 10-year quest to reach the top echelon of her sport, culminating in her silver medal win at the 1984 Los Angeles Olympics. Gilder, the founder and CEO of an investment business and the co-owner of the Seattle Storm, charts her journey from her privileged yet troubled upbringing in Manhattan to her years at Yale and beyond, when she pushed her body to its limit while fighting to bury a host of troubling emotions. Again, the book is Course Correction, a story of rowing and resilience in the wake of Title IX, and we welcome Ginny Gilder to the roundtable this morning. Thank you very much for being with us. A great pleasure.
Thank you so much, Joe, for inviting me.
Very nice to have you here. What led you to want to tell this story?
I guess part of it is I think there are a lot of people out there who act like everything's fine in life when things aren't necessarily so fine. In my experience, people always promote the good that's going on and aren't so comfortable talking about the things that are hard for them. And I struggled for so long with my own fears and was so afraid to tell anyone. It was really pretty debilitating at times. So I thought maybe if I could write this story, maybe somebody else would read it and not feel so alone in struggling through what challenges they had on their plate, and maybe not feel like they were so different from the rest of the world.
So much of this comes, obviously, from your quest to reach the top echelon of your sport. At this very crucial time in the wake of Title IX, how aware were you and obviously focused on the task at hand, but also aware of the politics that were going on around you?
I was not aware at all until I started college, and then everything started changing. My freshman year when I started rowing, and we had very unequal facilities at the boathouse at Yale. So I started September of 1975, and early in 1976, we started going out to the boathouse for practice. It was winter weather. We had two women on our team who were training for the 1976 Olympics, and that was the first time that women's rowing was allowed in the Olympics, so it was a big deal. And there were no showers for the women at the boathouse, and it was 12 miles from campus. So that whole experience of having to wait for the men, wet and cold, sitting on the bus while they got to take showers and then just drive back to campus, eat dinner still wet, really started making me aware of the inequities that existed. And plus, our captain, who was one of those women training for the Olympics, was a total firebrand, and she was aware of Title IX. I don't think I'd ever heard of Title IX before then. It was really only 3 years old, and I was 17. And I guess I was living in a little bit of a bubble before that. So that was the beginning of my becoming politicized, if you will.
You write a lot in the book, and there's many of these core emotions that you face, but fear is a big one that you write about and that you grapple. When did you start to realize that and come to terms with it?
I'm sorry to say that it was probably well into my 40s, and it's probably one of the reasons that it took so long to write this. It took me a long time to realize how much I was driven by that, what I call the naysayer voice in my head. Now, I got a lot accomplished despite that voice, and some could even argue maybe because of that voice. But I do think that if I had learned earlier to distinguish my fear a little more clearly, I would have become more adept at making different decisions. And really, if it sounds like you've read the book, what happened right before the 1984 Olympic trials, I think, is what you would call the nadir of stupidity, of letting my own fear of not being good enough drive me to the point of overtraining and really hurting my chances for doing what I had been working so hard to do.
What could have been gold?
Well, I could have raced in the single at the Olympics instead of the quad. And believe me, you know, 30 years later, it was a great experience. I'm not regretting any of it. But back then, it was devastating.
What's so interesting is that there is an anger. I mean, you mentioned the women sitting on the bus, cold and wet, waiting for the men to finish their showers. There is an anger at the situation that propels you and propels your teammates. And you work really, really hard on overcoming many of these obstacles. And yet, there is still that fear.
Yeah. It's interesting, isn't it? And I think a lot of that goes back to what happened as a preteen with my mom and having the bottom fall out of my life with her near suicide, and all of a sudden realizing that the future was not so predictable and not so count-onable, if you will. And I think that that core experience, unfortunately, set me up to not quite trust the future. And made me fearful instead of excited at points when maybe it would have been a lot more helpful to be excited.
Yeah, you look at those moments of growing up and on Park Avenue with your three siblings, living with your parents. You summer in East Hampton, and then your mother suffers a mental breakdown. She tries to take her own life. And this is after your father moves out to live with another woman and pretty much leaves you and your siblings to fend for yourselves.
That's right.
At that point, how much of is it conscious of how you're surviving, and how much of it is just doing what you need to do to survive?
I think as an 11-year-old, there is no question that there was no consciousness about it. It was more like being caught in a swirl of events and having absolutely no control, right? I mean, kids, for the most part, have no control over what's going on in their lives, especially when their parents are, I would characterize my parents' behavior as misbehaving. They were both in their own private worlds in agony and not able to think about what their kids needed. And I don't think that's actually that uncommon. But I was, along with my siblings, really just caught in a position of trying to figure out how to keep going. And I think that's what the focus was for a number of years. And of course, things stabilized. It wasn't like it was horrible every day by any means, but an aura of uncertainty had been injected into what was really probably a pretty idyllic life, at least from an 11-year-old's perspective. I'm sure as I had grown older, even without my mom's mental breakdown and my parents getting divorced, I would have discovered other problems in my family. But at 11, you're still pretty innocent.
And You are innocent, and you are also given you're given the opportunity to go to Yale. You're given the opportunity to do these things, to pursue rowing, to go to the Olympics, to win a silver medal. So that is not lost on you, of course.
No, you're right. There's no question. I was very lucky. Being from the family I was part of, my father was very financially successful, so he made a lot of things possible. Though he opened doors, there's no question about it. Getting to go and have an Ivy League education, tremendous leg up. Getting to be exposed to a new sport, huge opportunity. But, he wasn't exactly excited about my pursuing an Olympic career.
Right. Do you think your pursuit was in spite of that or despite that?
I think it was despite that. It's funny, I was just talking to a friend about it yesterday, and he said, "When did your father change his mind?" The problem was I loved rowing so much. He couldn't stop me. It wasn't to pay him back for anything. I just loved it, and I wanted to do it. It made me feel safe on the water. I felt like I understood it. It was hard. Oh, my God, it was so hard. And I loved that challenge. It was a very contained, structured challenge. And I did it because I couldn't not do it. And he finally got the picture in 1983, the year before the Olympics, when he came to the World Championships in Duisburg, when I was racing in the single, and he saw me racing in the single. And then he finally understood. And from then on, he was wildly supportive. Mm. But I really only had a year left.
You write about the years following the height of your rowing career, and obviously there was great emotional turmoil there as well. You give birth to a stillborn baby. You are married. It is a marriage that is not happy, and it's at this point you really come to terms with your sexuality.
Yeah, you know, it's funny, Joe. I don't know that I would say it wasn't happy. I would say it was an awkward marriage. I think my husband was pretty happy, and I tried so hard to be happy. I really tried.
Mm. Did you love him?
I think I did love him. Yes. Mm. But was I in love with him? I don't think so. I think I told myself I needed to do this, and I needed to find a good man, and he walked into my life at the right moment for that. Not necessarily the right moment for him. I don't know if he would say he regrets everything. I can't say I regret any of it, because I still care for him, and I adore my kids.
Mm.
So I wouldn't unwind any of it.
And a different love, of course, than that you feel with your wife, Lynn.
Yes, very different. I remember that when I started living with Lynn, so I got separated from my husband in 98, and we started living together in 99. So it was a long time ago now. I remember feeling all of a sudden this knot in my stomach that I'd always had suddenly just dissipated, and I felt internally so relaxed. And that was when I realized what I had been living with when I was married to my husband. But I had been so used to that sense of tension all the time, that internal anxiety, I didn't even recognize it anymore. It was just part of the scenery, if you will, the landscape of my interior life. And when I started living with Lynn, all that was gone.
So when you talk to women now, and you talk to young women and young women in sports, how relevant do you think your story is, in the sense of much of this has been dealt with societally, and much of it still has not?
I think this is an issue that goes well beyond Title IX, because, I mean, there is the whole aspect of access to opportunity that, I mean, you look at what's happening in terms of race relations in the United States, you look at what's happened in Baltimore last week, you look at women's sports. In some ways, it's all the same issue. How do people have a chance to, first of all, develop the capacity to dream, and then deliver on their dreams? That is a human issue. And well beyond the issue of Title IX is the issue of what happens when someone dares to dream. And really, we are so good as human beings at squashing each other's dreams. We just, like, do it practically reflexively. I know when my kids come up with a new idea, my first response is not usually, "You go, girl." That's not usually what I'm thinking. I'm coming up with 25 reasons why it's not going to work. And I have to learn to shut my mouth as a mom and just listen. So for me, when I talk to younger people, it's not about Title IX. It's about, don't let anyone define for you who you want to be. You get to decide who you're going to be. And only you get to decide when you're going to put a dream aside. Don't let other people do that for you. That's really, for me, the most important thing.
The name of the book is Course Correction, A Story of Rowing and Resilience in the Wake of Title IX. The book is published by Beacon Press. Jenny Gilder, a great pleasure to have you on the program. Thank you so much for sharing with us.
Joe, thank you so much for inviting me on.
Thank you very much. Again, the title of the book, Course Correction, A Story of Rowing and Resilience in the Wake of Title IX. The book is published by Beacon Press. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.